Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books Network. I'm Tiadam Silongkumar, the host of this channel, and today I'm here with Dr. Ross Ken to talk about his book, Syncretism and Christian Tradition, Race and Revelation in the Study of Religious Mixture. I think, personally, the title of the book itself is very attractive to me. In that sense, I'm also working on religious syncretism, and I'm also propounding for the use of the word syncretism, and also I'm dabbling in the very conceptual framework of trying to understand what religious syncretism is, and how do we understand, how do we use it in terms of trying to understand religion and the mixture of religions in that sense. So I think this book for me has been a very attractive book from the title itself, and also when I delve into the contents of the book, I think it really attracted me in the sense of how the historical narrative of the use of the word syncretism and in its use in theology, religious studies, and anthropology has been portrayed in the book. And that is where I think today I'm here with the author himself, Dr. Ross Ken, to talk about this book, Syncretism and Christian Tradition. So let me go straight to the author himself. So Dr. Ken, can you tell me something about yourself? Yeah.
Certainly. Thank you. And I'm delighted to be on this podcast and to talk about this book. So my name's Ross Kane, and I'm a professor, assistant professor of theology, ethics, and culture at Virginia Theological Seminary, which is a graduate school just outside of Washington, D.C. And my own areas of research cover religion and culture, Christian theology, and African Christianity. And it was in the intersection of these areas that brought me to explore this peculiar word in theology and religious studies, syncretism, since it's used in various disciplines, but used in very, very different ways.
And since your background, as you have said, is also on religious studies and also, you know, you have dealt on, the African traditions of Christianity and all of those aspects. So how did this book came about in terms of trying to analyze and understand syncretism? Yeah.
Well, let me start at a conceptual level and then speak at a more personal level. Conceptually, the book started with contrasting uses of the term syncretism. In my own doctoral program, we had many different areas of religious studies represented. And so we had anthropologists and historians, and then we had Christian theologians. And I was reading literature that used syncretism in very, very different ways. And it seemed to me that there was there could be some work done here in bringing some conceptual clarity to the term syncretism, and especially within Christian theology. It seemed to me there was quite a bit more nuance within the religious studies literature written by outsiders. And so that was the beginning. I noticed how for some theologians would call enculturation, an anthropologist would call syncretism, but a theologian would never call it syncretism. So I wanted to explore that question a little bit more. But before that, it really began within my own experiences. I was born and raised in the United States in the state of Virginia. And after I graduated from university, I lived overseas for a number of years in East Africa and was involved with some efforts by church groups and civil society in reconciliation between warring Southern Sudanese groups And I saw churches using all sorts of indigenous practices as part and parcel of their peacemaking. So in the sixth chapter of the book, I describe a bull sacrifice ritual carried out in South Sudan. And I experienced those when I was living in South Sudan, and experienced Christian bishops opening this bull ritual with prayer and Christian songs being offered. But as someone who was born and raised in the United States, this was something completely different for me. And when I described the experience to theologians in my graduate school, they just sort of dismissively called it syncretism. And it seemed to me there was more to say about it than that.
Yeah, I think the blend of your experience itself and then your academic expertise that comes together in bringing this book is something which is quite interesting, and it makes the book somehow, again, at the same time very interesting and also at the same time conceptually very in-depth in that sense. So let's go into the contents of the book and then go one question after the another, or one chapter after the another, and then let's just explore the book itself. So first of all, give us a glimpse of the history of the word syncretism, of its usage and of its origin. Yeah.
Sure. The use of the word goes back many centuries. The first use that we have in written literature is from Plutarch, and he used the word when talking about Greeks in Crete who were able to overcome their own quarrels when they had to face a common enemy. And this is actually the origin of the word syncretism. It's that the Crete in the middle is a reference to the Cretans. And in this sense, syncretism simply meant reconciling factions. And this was the association of the term for many, many centuries to follow. In the European Reformation, the term was used extensively as reference to theologians who were trying to bring different church parties together amid the fractions of the European Reformation. So Erasmus used the term, Zwingli and Calvin all used the term, again, for coalition building or reconciling factions. And then in the 17th century, a caustic connotation came into the word through a fierce Lutheran debate called the syncretism controversy, which you might talk about a little bit more later. But in that controversy, there became significant debate within the Protestant church, questioning the kind of coalition building that folks like Erasmus and others were carrying out. And they started to use the term in a very negative sense. And then really in the 18th and 19th centuries, the use of the term really moves between the one use of reconciling factions and the other use of questioning mixture. You have politicians in 19th century Europe using the word syncretism for nation building, a means of bringing many different constituencies in a body politic together into a single nation. You have philosophers using the word in a similarly positive sense, like Herder, for example, used the word fairly frequently. But you also have philosophers who used syncretism in a more negative way, saying that syncretism was an example when a school of philosophy would bring too many different ideas together, leading to incoherence instead of clarity. So the use was kind of all over the place, frankly, in the 18th and 19th centuries. It was really in the late 19th and early 20th century when the term settles into the realm of religion. And there it really takes two associations. First, it's a kind of neutral descriptor. Religious studies is a very early field at this point, but in the late 19th century, religious historians begin using the word syncretism to describe the ways that, say, Christianity would blend with Greek culture or Islam would blend with Arabic culture. And then it was in the early 20th century in Christian theology when it started to take a negative connotation. It became something more like an insult. So really kind of across the history here, and we've got 2,000 years or 1,800 years of use of syncretism in these very different senses. But you can basically break it down into four. You have syncretism as reconciling factions. So that's Erasmus, and that's Plutarch and others. You have syncretism as questioning mixture. So you have that in the syncretism controversy and among philosophers who think that syncretism leads to incoherence. Third, you have a neutral descriptor. Syncretism is just describing phenomena in the world without offering a judgment on it. And that's in religious studies. And then fourthly, you have syncretism as an epithet or as an insult in Christian theology.
Yeah, I mean, the broad stroke of how syncretism has been used is something quite interesting and tells a lot about the word itself and, you know, the disciplinary boundaries that it has crossed and how it has been used. And that's quite interesting. So let us go one by one. And firstly, I want to focus on the Christian use of the word syncretism. And as you have said, in the 17th century, there was a debate. And in the 20th century, in the Christian circle, it has been used as something where, you know, chalk out the other from the very Christian domain or a Christian boundary, something like that. So in a sense, it became a pejorative word, right? So tell us something about the history of the debate in terms of the word syncretism in the theological or the Christian theological usage. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, there's really three things that come together to make the word syncretism become pejorative in Christian theology. So the first is that syncretism controversy. The second is a worry about revelation, a concern that God's revelation for theologians be as clear as it can possibly be. And then the third aspect is racism. So the syncretism controversy that we just mentioned in the 17th century, in my experience, Christian theology doesn't talk a lot about this controversy today, but it was a very fierce and well-known controversy in its own time. Basically pitted two significant Lutheran theologians against one another. One was named Calixtus, and Calixtus was trying to advocate a very broad expression of Christianity, a kind of big tent Christianity that could in fact reconcile Lutherans, Reformed churches, and Catholics. He was desiring Christian unity after the difficulties of not just the Reformation, but he lived also through the 30 Years' War, which was of course a time of great religious upheaval and religious conflict. Now, there were others in the Lutheran Church who were not so excited about this kind of broad expression of Christianity. They thought the Reformation was at stake, that Christianity should be as defined as it can possibly be. And so that meant a fairly narrow expression of Christian theology. And that camp was led by a theologian named Calovius. It was a time of great invective in the church. This debate was not kind. Calovius, for example, called Calixtus's work the excrements of Satan. And so it was Calovius who added this caustic sense to the term. And what's at stake here for these two theologians is, you know, what Christian theology is often called the rule of faith. You know, what are those aspects of the faith that are seen as essential, and what are those where there can be disagreement? And they disagreed fiercely about that. So that added the caustic sense to the term. Now, more recently, though, it wasn't until the late 19th, really 20th, early 20th century that syncretism became fully pejorative in Christian theology. So the first concern there was about revelation. This was a concern about the purity of the Christian message. By the 19th and early 20th centuries, Christianity had been spreading rapidly across the world and would continue to do so throughout the 20th century. And amid that expansion, there were many different cultural expressions of Christianity in various parts of the world. And many, especially European missionaries and theologians, were concerned about the purity of Christianity. They wanted to see that the revelation of God in Christ can be expressed in as clear a way as possible, and in a way that isn't unduly influenced by culture. Now, what ended up happening was that all of those expressions of Christianity that were considered syncretism, which was, you know, undue mixture with surrounding cultures or other religions, almost all of the named syncretisms in the early 20th century for European Christian theologians were from Africa, from Latin America, and from Asia. And so clearly there is some racism that gets embedded within the term, because at this point, discourses about syncretism are getting mixed up in wider discourses about racism. Again, during this period, this is a new height of racism in Europe and North America. You have the eugenics movements in both of those continents. And so syncretism just got caught up in those intellectual waters. It's not like missiologists and theologians were saying, oh, all non-white expressions of Christianity are syncretism. It's how they use the term. So you rarely, if ever, I mean, I've spent years researching this. I could almost never find an instance where a European theologian would call European theology syncretism. It was almost always reserved for Africa, Latin America, and Asian forms of Christianity. So those three things really come together to make the word pejorative. You have the syncretism controversy, which gave that caustic sense to the term. You have this concern about the purity of Christianity and the Christian message and God's revelation being pure. And then you have syncretism getting caught up in these wider discourses about racism, where pure Christianity, sort of unalloyed Christianity, ends up becoming white European Christianity.
Yeah, and I think that's quite interesting, because now also, even till today, the word syncretism by Christian theologians or Christians, they use this one in a very negative sense. And I've also personally encountered those aspects. And also at the same time, recently I was having a conversation with a professor, and he was also kind of pointing out that, you know, the use of syncretism has been negative in the sense of it has been used by the European missionaries, and also we should avoid kind of using the word syncretism and all. But then I had different opinions on that. But that's quite interesting as to how you have brought out and how you have seen the very aspect of syncretism in Christian theology and how it has grown. I mean, you have shown the history, right, of how this has grown. The word has been used. Also, at the same time, as the subtitle of the book, your book suggests that how race has been intermingled with the use of the word syncretism in that sense. So I think that is where I think the aspect of where is separate between the Asian Christianity or the Asian religion or Eastern religions, and then, you know, looking at the European Christianity as somehow which is very pure in that sense, has something that has to do with how syncretism had been used. So I think that aspect of the usage of syncretism in Christianity itself is something quite interesting that you have brought out in your work. So let's go to the second aspect, and I think I'd like you to ask about this one, where, you know, the use of syncretism in religious studies and anthropology, actually. So since I come from the anthropological study of religion, I mean, syncretism is something which is used, not in a negative sense, but in religious studies, anthropology is used in a very quite decent sense in this. And in anthropology, recently, there has been some debates about the very usage of the conceptual framework of syncretism itself. And in religious studies, this word is also used. So how has this word been used and developed in the area of religious studies and anthropology? Yeah,
you're right. It's used in a fairly neutral sense. It's used as a description of observed phenomena. And for me, as someone who works sort of in both religious studies and anthropology as well as Christian theology, it was the kind of dissonance between these uses of the term that was so striking. So there's really basic two senses within religious studies and anthropology. You have syncretism as a neutral descriptor, and that's especially within religious studies. And one of the key insights that religious studies scholars provide is that syncretism is simply pervasive in religion. There is no way for a religious tradition to avoid syncretism, that humans will always be expressing religion within a cultural environment, and that cultural environment has shaped all humans. Our cultures have shaped us all in ways that we cannot avoid, and shouldn't seek to avoid. But that there can't be a kind of pure uncultured religion. So for religious studies scholars, it's simply a universal phenomenon within religions. Now, this isn't something that religious scholars recognized from the beginning. It was something that it was an insight that grew really kind of from the early mid 20th century. There was a time in religious studies when scholars tended to view religions as fairly freestanding entities that didn't syncretize unless some sort of cultural phenomenon or political phenomenon like conquest or something would press the matter. Religious scholars in the mid 20th century started to revise that assessment and recognize what religious traditions are always mixing with whatever is around them, even those who even when they're not encountering one another. So that's that first sense, that neutral descriptor. And then anthropology, it's used as a descriptor, but sometimes has a celebratory tone to it as well. Many anthropologists wanted to highlight the creativity at play when people adapt, especially large religious traditions like Christianity and Islam, to their own cultural context and their own environment. For anthropologists, this was not necessarily an act of betraying a tradition, as it was for many theologians. It was rather an act of great creativity and an expression of agency, and often a means of fighting against some of the imperial aspects of traditions like Christianity and Islam. So for me, that tension between syncretism as an inevitable phenomena in any religious tradition and Christian theologians who are trying to hold on to an unsyncretized Christianity became, like I said, one of the guiding forces behind writing this book. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the line that you have said about syncretism being an unavoidable phenomenon is something which is true in that sense. I mean, syncretism happens in terms of how religious meet and come together and, you know, and cultures and traditions come together. And that is quite interesting as to how religious, the word syncretism has been used in religious studies and how it has developed and how it is today and also its usage in anthropology itself. So by your work and by the tone of how you are describing syncretism itself, you advocate for the retention of the usage of the word syncretism with some caveat, right? With some understanding the certain aspect of syncretism with some caveat, but also you talk about tradition, how, you know, the syncretism can be understood through the usage of the tradition and, you know, how syncretism can be used in certain ways. So how do you understand syncretism in terms of tradition and how do we use syncretism in that sense? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, there's been significant debate in religious studies about whether scholars should even keep using the word syncretism. And you know, there's been a few arguments against it. One argument is that syncretism could assume an essentialism in religion that overlooks the fluidity of any religious tradition. These are descriptions of syncretism in which you would have one freestanding religious tradition encountering another, and then syncretism ensues. And religious studies scholars would say, no, syncretism's actually always been there. So there's that worry about essentializing religion. The second worry is that if it is a universal phenomenon in religion, why should we bother to delineate it? It's everywhere. And so what's the point? And then the third worry is that the pejorative use of the term in Christian theology is just too ingrained in the word. Now, I think that each of these concerns can be addressed. I think in terms of the first concern about essentialism, I don't think syncretism needs to assume essentialism within a religious tradition. I think it would assume continuity within a religious tradition, but you can have traditions that are always undergoing change, that encounter one another, and syncretism is kind of the best word out there for describing what's happening. We don't really have a better one yet. If we did, you know, I'm certainly open to revising my opinion. The second concern that it's because it's universal, it shouldn't be used. I don't find that persuasive because there's all sorts of words that have that problem. And we keep using them. We have words like society and politics, and religion itself, for that matter. These are all words that refer to fairly widespread phenomena, but we use them because that's they still describe something that other words don't quite describe. And I think syncretism's in that category. In terms of this pejorative history, it seems to me that anthropologists have given us a way through here, that anthropologists have shown that the negative connotation of of the word can be turned on its head, and you know what Foucault would call a kind of reverse discourse, that its negative associations can actually be harnessed for some moral good, which is empowering those who have been insulted from having been called syncretists. And you mentioned my use of the word tradition here, and it really is a vital concept in the book, because I think that for religious studies scholars, anthropologists, theologians, if we are going to recognize that syncretism is pervasive, and we have to have some way of making sense of our tradition, of our, you know, what's often called religions, even, you know, and that's a controversial term now as well. We have to have some way of describing them that accounts for the constant fluidity and flux of syncretism. Now, there can be constant syncretism, but there can also be continuity. And I just haven't found another word other than tradition that quite holds those things together. Now, the challenge here is that tradition is often used in a very stultified sense, but it's not traditionalism, it's tradition. And so I mean tradition in the sense of something, you know, its original Latin origin, which is, you know, to hand something on. So tradition as something that always involves handing on and adapting, but alongside continuity.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting way of how we can use the word syncretism and how the word can be written in the scholarly discourse of trying to understand religious traditions as such. So I think that is quite interesting. And I think the last two chapters kind of delves into the theological aspect of it. And, you know, for me, I come from India, the Northeast India, and to my people, the Southern Baptists, the American Southern Baptists brought Christianity to my people almost two centuries ago. And I think Christianity has something which is like culturally, I come from that background, and I've really delved into the thinking processes of the historical and theological aspect of Christianity in that sense. And that is an area also which I'm very much interested in. So coming to the next question here about Christ, right? Jesus Christ, something which all Christians in that sense think about and, you know, in one way or the other delve about. And, you know, Christ is the center of Christianity in that sense. So how do we understand, as the Christian theology portrays it, how do we understand Christ's humanity and divinity in terms of syncretism here? Because I think you have brought out some discussion between two theologians in this very book itself. And then you have kind of brought out the aspect of Christ's humanity and divinity and how we can understand it through the usage of the syncretism. So how do we really understand this aspect of Christ? Yeah.
Yes, yes. And you're right. The book sort of pivots starting around the fifth chapter. So the fifth and the sixth chapters really move directly into theological engagement with challenges of syncretism. The introduction in chapters 1 through 4 are really written for theologians and religious studies scholars alike. So one can be an insider studying their own tradition, one can be an outsider studying Christian tradition and benefit from those first 4 chapters. But the last 2 really get much more specific, engaging Christian theology. And like you say, the question of Jesus' humanity and divinity is a theme that comes out across these final 2 chapters. I mean, the first thing I'd say before even getting into Christ's divinity and humanity is that in Christian theology, we have to recognize that culture simply is part of human beings expressing theology. And that's the basic point that religious studies and anthropologist scholars point out, and I don't think that we have grounds for disagreeing with that conclusion. And so if humans expressing theology through their culture is simply part and parcel of theology itself, then instead of bemoaning the variations that come from Christians in various parts of the world expressing Christianity, instead of looking for some kind of pure Christian message that could exist outside of culture, why don't we see culture as part of the giftedness of God's good creation? That it was part of God's intentions in this world to create difference and to allow that difference to speak to the presence of the divine within the world that God made. So that's a kind of basic orientation that grounds the theological work. When it comes to, you know, Christ's humanity and divinity, a major theme within this book in terms of the person of Christ is the continuing incarnation of Christ across history through Christ's own body. So you have Christ, as Apostle Paul describes, Christ is the head of the body. So you have Christ as the head. But then as more and more people are baptized into Christian tradition, Christ's body over history, in a sense, is growing because more and more people are being brought into it. And it's that growing body across time that I emphasize in terms of Christ's humanity. That Christ's humanity is not just the humanity of the first century Jewish prophet and rabbi, but Christ's humanity is the body of Christ that we are incorporated into, that we as humans bring our bodies into Christ's body, and Christ's body reflects the diversity of humanity. So the idea is that more and more cultures come to shape Christ's body. And that this is nothing to be worried about. In fact, it's something to be celebrated. And we find it across Christian tradition. So just take the example from the New Testament of parables. You know, that was a first century idiom for teaching that Jesus used across his ministry. And this simple idiom of parables became a means of God's revelation being expressed anew to human beings through the person of Christ. We jump ahead a couple of centuries, and then we have Greek philosophy, ancient Greek philosophy, being a means by which Christians see more of Christ. And one of the great examples that I talk about in the book is the use of the word homoousios, the Greek word, which in the Nicene Creed is translated of one being or of one substance. That Jesus is, Christ is of one being with the Father. Homoousios is not a term from the Christian scriptures. In fact, there was a council before the Nicene Council in Antioch in the third century, which said that homoousios should not be used when describing the person of Christ. But then over time, the word became retooled, and Christian theologians began to see that there was some great potential to this word. It was a word straight out of Greek philosophy, and particularly from Gnostic sects of Christianity, actually, is where it originated. But there again, so you have another moment in which a cultural idiom has become a means of seeing more of Jesus through these debates of the early church. And then in the sixth chapter, I give another example from the contemporary church. There's a few examples, but I think the strongest is the role that ancestors play within African Christianity and the way that African theologians, and it's not exclusive to Africa, but that's my own area of research, ways in which African theologians recognize the importance of ancestors, especially in the Old Testament, and bring that back into Christian theology, because it's an area that Christian theology has not necessarily paid a great deal of attention to. So here again, you have this cultural idiom in we have Christianity being expressed within a cultural idiom, and these cultures actually become ways of seeing more of Jesus. Ways the Spirit uses to show aspects of Jesus that we haven't necessarily seen. So syncretism actually becomes this means by which Christ's divinity and Christ's humanity communicate with each other.
That's quite interesting. Yeah, and also, you know, there is this in page 182 and the 83 of the book, there is this line that which I was quite interested in, intrigued with. And the line goes something like this, where it says, "Revelation is knowledge of the divine forged in the crucible of the material history. Thus, divine revelation does not simply indel the teaching of doctrine. It enables a new future. Revelation is not mainly a doctrine, Ilas says, but a promise. And I think that line itself of revelation itself of is something which is quite interesting thing to see the and know the idea of revelation and then look at revelation in that sense, right? And as you have said, the debate of syncretism in Christian theology has mostly to do with revelation in that sense. And I think how you describe Christ's divinity and humanity and how we should understand it, and also how we should understand it in terms of revelation of how, you know, the revelation of how it is described here. I think the readers will have to get the book and then try to go into the kind of things that have been discussed here on the aspect of revelation. And I'm sure the readers will really the benefit from the book itself. So let's come to the last chapter. And I think the last chapter itself is something like this. By the reading of it, I kind of feel that you are giving a proposal or you're proposing something to the Christian theologian. So when Christians, as Christians, we come and contact with other tradition, you know, there are certain aspects which we can syncretize, but there are certain aspects which we cannot, you know, we can be careful of. So, I mean, there's this kind of proposal. And I think when I look at the last chapter, and when you talk about the veneration of the ancestors and all, you know, since you are from America and all, the debate in America, the theological circle, the Christian theological circle of debate between the conservative and the progressive is very high. And when people read your last chapter, I'm sure you will get some comments from people from the other side. But I think the last chapter, in that sense, for me as an anthropologist and as a scholar of religion, I think this is something which I believe need to be carried out and practiced in the Christian theological circle itself, right? So how do you propose the last chapter in the terms of usage of syncretism when Christian or Christianity coming in contact with other tradition?
Hmm. You know, that quote you gave is really... It's really based in the work of the Cameroonian theologian Jean-Marc Ella, who's someone who talks quite a lot about ancestors, and I just love that sense of revelation, like you say, as a promise, something that isn't sort of just given to us from the past, and all we have to do is repeat it. It's not a theology of repetition. Rather, it's if revelation is a promise, then there will be, we should expect innovation within the tradition. So. Ella is one major theological figure in the last two chapters, and then Rowan Williams is the other. In terms of your question here, Rowan Williams once made a distinction. I don't make a lot of this in the book, but it's a really nice summary of what the last chapter is trying to do. Rowan Williams once made a distinction between a posture of authenticity as the Christian message spreads versus a posture of expectation. And he would say that for much of Christian mission history, there has been a posture of authenticity. And that is expressed in a concern that the core tenets of Christianity be handed down. But there hasn't necessarily been apt attention to the way in which that concern was expressed based on European understandings of Christianity. And so that concern for authenticity has sometimes inhibited this sense that God's revelation is not just something from the past, but is a promise to Christians for a new future. A posture of expectation, on the other hand, as Christianity spreads, it wouldn't be unconcerned about authenticity. That's a concern for any tradition. But a posture of expectation would, when Christianity is expressed, or when there's in a new place, or when one Christian experiences an expression of Christianity that's different from theirs, instead of starting with a worry about authenticity, what if we started with a sense of expectation that the Holy Spirit could be saying something new about Christianity that we've just not encountered before? And we could start there, start then with a sense of expectation, and then go to the worry about authenticity. But for most of modern Christian history, those have been reversed. And the last chapter is basically saying, well, what if we come thinking, what if we encounter the unfamiliar with a posture of receptivity instead of defensiveness? And, you know, in the last chapter, I go through a couple of examples. One is ancestor reverencing. The other is a bull sacrifice ritual, the one I described earlier. And I go through those as and give those as examples of new and coherent expressions of Christian tradition. And then I give some examples of Christianity that seem beyond the bounds of tradition. And one is, because I work in African studies, all the examples are African. So one is the example of Afrikaner nationalism, which combined Christianity with an apartheid state. And that can seem like too easy of an example at first, but the idea is actually to say South Africa is not an unusual example of Christians combining nationalism with racism and their Christian commitments. This was part of much of 20th century European history, much of 19th, 20th century United States history. So the idea is not to sort of, play tennis with the net down, if you will, but to say this example that's so vibrant for many in the contemporary moment is actually much more familiar than we might think. And then the other example is of a Christian group in Zimbabwe who do not hold the Bible to be revelatory. And, as it's interesting, some of the feedback I've gotten about the book, you mentioned that a lot of theologians might be a bit concerned about examples like bull sacrifice and ancestor reverencing. I've also gotten feedback that I'm too concerned about things like the group in Zimbabwe that, theologians shouldn't see themselves as a judge, and that perhaps I'm actually going against my own arguments by voicing concern about these expressions. But I see myself as part of the conversation there. I don't see myself as giving a final word by any means, but as trying to offer a sort of guide for reflection as a conversation continues within theology and religious studies about syncretism and Christian tradition.
Yeah, and I think the last chapter is a very good way to end the book itself in the sense of proposing a discussion, a ground for discussion, right? And I think that is something quite interesting. And also, this book itself is something like this where it can be read by theologians, the religious studies scholar, it can be read by anthropologists, sociologists, anyone, and all can come together and try to kind of clean from this book. And I think the beauty in the sense of this book is here, and I think that's quite interesting of how you portrayed the understanding of syncretism and the history of it. So is there anything that I've missed out in the question that you want to talk about or say something about the book? Yeah.
You've been an excellent reader, and I've really appreciated this conversation. It's been a wonderful opportunity to sort of look back on this project. As for many scholars, it was a project that was many, many years in the making. It started as a paper for a class in graduate school and turned into a dissertation, and has now been turned into a book. So it's nice to see all these years of work in a book that can be appreciated by others. So this has really been terrific to have this conversation.
Yeah, that's really good. So, any other new projects that you're working on or anything exciting coming ahead of you in terms of your scholarly work?
Sure. I have two kind of small projects I'm working on right now. One is I'm co-editing with the African ethicist Simeon Olesimi, a reader in African political theologies. And that's been a really exciting project to be a part of. And I'm also just finishing up a very short text on political theology and Christian tradition with a strong focus on local parishes and congregations. So those are smaller projects. The big project that I'm planning to work on next is a project that explores it really carries forward this idea of Christ's incarnation continuing across history, and exploring that idea and doing kind of something like an integrative survey of various expressions of Christ's body being manifested today in different cultures, and finding some resonances between different writers, and offering that as a means of giving just a different perspective into some classic Christological questions in Western Christianity, especially questions about a perceived contrast between a Jesus of history and a Christ of faith. I mean, one thing in the initial explorations I'm finding is how cultural a question that is for Western Christians, and that this perceived divide between a Jesus of history walking around ancient Palestine and Jesus as expressed across history is a divide that's not shared in many other cultures in Christianity. And so, as Jean-Marc Ayllat, that Cameroon theologian I mentioned, said, he said, sometimes if Western Christianity is to overcome its own contradictions, it has to draw from other wells. And so that next book is basically a project based on Ayllat's insight.
Very interesting project ahead. The very expression of Christ in cultures, right? In India, the tribal theologians, we have tribal theologians, right? And what they try to do is that they'll try to look at the pre-Christian animistic beliefs and take out the deities from these beliefs and then try to relate it to Jesus Christ, actually, and try to explain or talk about Jesus Christ through these pre-Christian deities, right? So that is quite interesting about tribal theology in India itself, also the expression of Christ from the cultural perspective of, you know, pre-Christian cultural perspective, right? That's quite interesting. So I think it has been really nice talking with you. And for me, as personally, as I'm also working on syncretism, and also I'm also advocating for the word, I think I've come across you who have really worked in depth on this very work. So I think to any listeners, I think you should get a book and then go through it, and then you should see for yourself how syncretism can be used in our academic work and in our daily lives, right? And how it can be understood. Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Ken, for being here with me and talking about your book. Take care, and thank you very much. Yeah.
Oh, thanks very much, and all the best in your research. It's been a real pleasure to chat today.